This is the Everything Financial Radio program. I am your host, Dennis Tubergen. Welcome. We are here every week at this time, and this is where we talk about what's going on in the economy, what it might mean for your money, and we look at things often from an historical perspective. We believe your history professor was right. Those who don't study history are doomed to repeat it, and we believe that economic cycles that repeat themselves over and over again are based upon predictable human behavior. So welcome. If you're a new listener, if you're a regular listener, thank you for tuning in again. I have a great show lined up for you today. I'm going to be chatting momentarily with best-selling author Mr. Harry Dent. His most recent book is titled The Demographic Cliff, How to Survive the Great Deflation from 2014 to 2019. Mr. Dent will be joining me for a couple segments today, and I'm pleased to have him back on the program again. I'll be talking about the Fed's decision this past week to keep interest rates at zero, which was no surprise. I believe they have no choice in that matter, but more importantly, we'll talk about what that means for you and your money, and does this interest rate decision, keeping interest rates at zero, mean that we're going to have inflation in the future? I'll give you my take on how that ties in with the Fed's decision and what I think it means for you and your money. And by popular demand, by request, I'm going to be talking on today's program about how to maximize your Social Security benefits potentially for you and your spouse. We're doing a separate workshop on this in Grand Rapids a couple times a month now. That is by invitation only. And we will talk about on today's program a couple strategies you may not be aware of. So you want to stay tuned for that as well. Quick reminder about the new retirement rules class. We've got one coming up on March the 28th. That is a Saturday. The class will begin at 9 a.m. and will conclude at 2:30 p.m. It'll be held at Western Michigan University's downtown campus. The cost of the class for you and a guest is just $49, and that covers the book you'll get before the class to do some reading. We'll assign you some light reading before the class so you can get the most out of your day. And then we'll also give you handouts at the class. And the $49 even covers lunch for you and a guest. When you leave the class, you'll have a resource that we believe will be very valuable as you do some retirement income planning. And we believe it'll give you also a perspective that you likely won't find anywhere else. So if you'd like to get more information on the class, just visit newretirementrules.com. You can register there while capacity remains, or just get more information if you'd like more information there as well. If you would like to listen to any of our interviews with our guest experts again, it's easy to do. All you have to do is go to the iTunes store and search under Everything Financial Radio, and you can download the program each week in the form of two podcasts. So again, go to iTunes, search under Everything Financial Radio. I'm pleased to have as a returning guest on the program best-selling author Mr. Harry Dent. Harry's most recent book is The Demographic Cliff, How to Survive and Prosper During the Great Deflation of 2014 to 2019. He is also the editor of the free newsletter, Economy and Markets. And Harry, welcome back to the program.
Yeah, nice to be back, Dennis.
Harry, let's start with the premise of your most recent book, The Demographic Cliff, How to Survive and Prosper During the Great Deflation of 2014 to 2019. Explain the premise of the book to the listeners.
Well, you know, way back in the late 80s, I came up with a unique, very summary leading indicator for the economy and the stock markets. It's called the spending wave. We just moved forward the birth index, which we adjust for immigration in countries like the U.S., where we have a lot of immigration. We just moved forward that birth index for the peak in spending of the average person, which, you know, government surveys every year show is right at age 46. But different countries have different baby boomers. So we've had this, we said all the way back from the late 80s forward, this is going to be the greatest boom in history, especially the 1990s, where we had the great tech bubble and Dow going over 10,000 when nobody thought that was possible. That was our forecast all the way back in the early 90s. It's just baby boomers moving into their peak spending. And then, of course, we kind of hit that peak in 2007, right on line where our indicator said. And we've been fighting a struggling economy ever since. Baby boomers don't want to borrow more money. People only pay down debt. They don't want to. They want to save and spend less. And governments are, you know, just pouring money into the economy to fill the ditch, I call it. But the key point of this book is that different parts of the world hit this demographic peak and go off what I call a demographic cliff at different times. Japan did this first. They had a double peak late 89 and late 96, and you know, after both of those, the economy fell, and they've never gotten back up. You know, again, despite non-ending stimulus, their stock market has been down 82% at worst. Their real estate market's down 60%, and has never really bounced, because even now, we show in the book, in chapter three, we call real estate will never be the same. Japan has shown that when you have a smaller generation follow a larger one, you get to a point in the housing market where there's more older people dying, and they're sellers, obviously, than young people buying for their families in their 30s and early 40s. So Japan never bounced, even when the next generation came along, because of this factor. So we look at how demographics hit one country after the next, Japan, and then obviously the U.S. Europe is the next to go off the cliff. Germany has the worst demographic downtrends of any country in the world, and everybody thinks Germany's the strong man in Europe, and they're going to hold up the euro. And Japan had major stock crash, bubble burst, real estate crash, everything like that in the 90s when the rest of the world was having the greatest boom in history. So it shows how it's hard to fight sliding demographic trends. So you know, South Korea will be the last country in East Asia to go off the cliff after 2018. But we all developed countries. There's only six small countries from kind of like Switzerland to Australia kind of size that have a larger echo baby boom or millennial generation boom than the baby boom. All the rest of the countries either have very little echo boom or have one that's similar in size but not larger. So this is the first time in history we've seen this. So we're just showing, look, this is going to hit. And we've had a third stock bubble now. This one's fueled totally by Fed stimulus and quantitative easing, just driving up stocks, driving up companies artificially. And it's going to burst. And we've already seen two bubbles burst, and now people don't think this one can. And I said, you know, you got to be crazy. You know, bubble burst in 2000, bubble burst after 2007, and the bubble is due to burst, I'd say, this year. And every crash has been deeper. That's what we show, a megaphone pattern. Every crash has gone, taken us to new lows. So I think the Dow is going to go from somewhere around 19,000 soon to, by early 2017 or late 2016, to about 5,500 to 6,000. This is something you cannot sit through as an investor, and I think this is going to be the final bubble to burst. And like the long-term peaks in 1929 and 1968 in the U.S. stock market, we didn't get back to those levels adjusted for inflation for 23, 24 years. So we're telling investors, you've got to protect your assets, wait for this great reset. Bubbles are going to burst across the board like they did in 2008, and then you can reinvest longer term. But this is not a downturn to sit through. Diversification will not help you, because when bubbles burst, everything goes down. I keep reminding people, in 2008, real estate, commodities, gold and silver, U.S. stocks, European stocks, emerging market stocks, Japanese stocks, everything went down except the highest quality bonds. And the U.S. dollar, all these gold bugs are telling people, oh, the dollar's going to go to zero, we're debasing our currency. We're not debasing nearly as fast as Japan or Europe and other countries, so we are the best house in a bad neighborhood. So we just look at what businesses can do and what investors to do to basically survive going off this cliff. It's kind of like you're on a river and you're getting ready to go off over a waterfall. A normal, nice boat will not save you. You need a hang glider, you know. You need a different strategy to get over this reset.
We're chatting today with Mr. Harry Dent, who is the author of The Demographic Cliff. Harry, we've got about two and a half minutes left here. Recently, we saw the January numbers, the CPI numbers came in negative. Is this the beginning of the Great Deflation that is the subtitle of your book?
Yeah, well, you know, it's already started in Europe. I mean, Europe's been on the deflation side in the last year, so we're getting close. Oil prices collapsing is just another one. I mean, and that's what deflation is. Everything goes down in price. Commodities, you know, oil, even gold, you know, stocks, healthcare and education costs should go down at some point, which would be a huge boon. It's just a big shift when this first happens. It's a big shock to for the economy, a big shock to the stock market. Deflation periods always follow, and you look at history, this is crystal clear, always follow major debt and financial asset bubbles. It's a way of kind of resetting these bubbles in debt, restructuring debt, financial assets go back down to reality. That destroys a lot of money and wealth, so there's fewer dollars chasing the same goods. Long term, this is a very good thing. It's going to make the standard of living and housing and all types of things more affordable to the next young generation, but short term, it's going to kill the baby boomers who own most of the financial assets, especially the top 0.1% to 10%.
Well, Harry, we've got about 30 seconds left, which is a perfect amount of time to let the listeners know how they can learn more about your work.
Yeah, you know, harrydent.com, we've got a free daily newsletter. It's high content, very good for my and two of my other associates at Dent Research, and it's free. It's a way for people to get to know us, and then we have other newsletters, and you can learn more about our research and other newsletters at dentresearch.com. But harrydent.com, you just go in, put in your email, and you're on our newsletter.
Terrific. Well, I will continue my conversation with Mr. Harry Dent when Everything Financial Radio returns. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Everything Financial Radio program. I'm your host, Dennis Tubergen. Glad you decided to tune in today. We'll continue a very informative conversation with Mr. Harry Dent in the next segment. You know, there was a lot of talk this past week that the Federal Reserve decided to leave interest rates unchanged. Well, what does that mean, and what does it mean for you, and why did they make that decision? Well, I'm going to share with you a couple articles this segment, one from MarketWatch and another from the New York Times that talk about the Fed's decision, and I'll give you a bit from the MarketWatch article to start. The Federal Reserve evidently thinks unemployment can fall to 5% or slightly less without stoking an inflationary bonfire. Now, what does this mean? Well, the theory is, and the article does a fairly decent job of explaining it as well, but the theory is that the more people that are working, the more demand is created, and that demand will cause prices to go up. Now, the true definition of inflation, as we've talked about here on the Everything Financial Radio program, is really an expansion of the money supply. So let me just continue with this MarketWatch article. It says, in the latest economic forecast, the central bank cut its long-term cut estimate of the U.S. unemployment rate to a range of 5% to 5.2%. Now, why is that significant, the article asks? Because the Fed previously seemed to believe unemployment could not fall to below 5.2% without causing inflation to rise. Well, the one thing you have to understand about the unemployment rate as it relates to inflation is that the unemployment rate doesn't really reflect the labor market. In fact, the current unemployment rate of 5.5%, which actually with the February jobs report where 295,000 jobs were added, is really not reflective as to what's really going on in the labor market. There's a lot of part-time jobs being created. There's a lot of people working part-time that want to work full-time. And when you take a look at the labor force participation rate, one of the reasons the unemployment rate is so low is that a number of people have simply dropped out of the workforce. So when the Fed sets these targets saying that we're not going to have inflation until the unemployment rate drops to 5%, I would think that the unemployment rate could drop even lower than that because the unemployment rate is really not reflective as to the actual conditions in the labor market. So this is almost a smoke and mirrors argument in my mind. Now to continue what the article said, this is the MarketWatch article, the central bank seems prepared to let the unemployment rate drop to 5% or even lower without feeling an urgent need to sharply boost interest rates that are now near zero. The theory that lower unemployment causes higher inflation because of rising upward pressure on wages is known as the non-accelerating inflation of unemployment, or the economists call it NARU. Now, a number of economists would debate that this NARU theory is valid. When you look at, historically speaking, when inflation has kicked in, the unemployment rate at the time has really been all over the board. Now, if you take a look at the last time the Fed was in this situation, it's interesting because now the Federal Reserve present chairperson, Janet Yellen, was actually a first-time board member on the Fed back in 1996. And she suggested at that time that because labor markets were tight, interest rates should probably be raised. Well, Fed Chairman Alan Greenspan at the time disagreed. He argued that strong productivity gains would keep inflation in check, and Greenspan actually ended up being right. But there's one big difference between today's economy and the economy of the 90s. In the economy of the 90s, there were a number of full-time jobs being added, and they were good-paying jobs, and that's simply not the case today. I'll give you a bit from the New York Times article titled, After a Balance, Wage Growth Slumps to 0.1%. This was published on March the 6th. The article states the economy is adding jobs at a rapid pace, and that's according to the Labor Department February report. But there's still one major holdout to the recovery, and that is wages. Employers increased their payrolls by 295,000 workers in February, which was above expectations, and the unemployment rate fell to 5.5%, its lowest point since the spring of 2008. That's good news, right? Well, not really, because wage gains continue to lag. Wages were up only 0.1% in February for private sector workers. That means that over the last year, private sector workers have seen wage growth of only 2% over the last year. Now, job growth really, and this tells you really where the jobs are being created. Of the 295,000 jobs being created, 66,000 were in leisure and hospitality, and 54,000 were in education and health. Construction added only 29,000 jobs, and manufacturing only 8,000. So you can see that a lot of the jobs are in the service sector, which traditionally hires many part-time workers. If you take a look at the labor force participation rate, which the New York Times article talks about, and this is again from the article, another reason for the disenchantment with the wage growth and jobs report is that millions of potential workers remain detached from the job market. The labor force participation rate, which counts both those with jobs and those looking for them, has stabilized, but at lows last seen in the late 1970s. The labor force participation rate once again fell in February to 62.8% from 62.9%. Well, what does that mean? It means that only 62.8% of those that are of working age are in the labor force. 37.2% are not. And when you take a look at the number of folks working part-time, just because they can't find full-time work, 25.1% or one out of four part-time workers would rather be working full-time, and yet for economic reasons they're working part-time. Part of the reason for this, as we've discussed in the past, is that private sector debt levels are at significant historic highs. Private sector debt levels tend to be deflationary in nature, and that's one of the reasons that we haven't seen big wage growth. And the quantitative easing in which the Fed engaged did not create inflation simply because these private sector debt levels are at all-time highs. Now, we believe that the economy will continue to grow at a sluggish pace. In fact, we think we will see a contraction in the economy, and we think that that will likely lead to potentially some bad news for stocks, and when interest rates rise, that could mean bad news for bonds as well. We're in what we call an economic winter season. If you'd like to learn about some strategies that you might consider to manage your nest egg in this economic winter season, I'd like to invite you to check out a resource that we've made available. The resource is our new retirement rules class. It is held on March the 28th will be our next class. It is a Saturday. The class will begin at 9 a.m. and will conclude at 2:30 p.m. The cost for the class for you and a guest, the book, all the handouts, and lunch is just $49. All you have to do to register is go to the website, newretirementrules.com. That class is filling up quickly. We do have some capacity yet. So if you want to go check it out or register, again, the website is newretirementrules.com. We'll be back after these words. Stay with us.
Give me your money. Just give me money. Money.
This is the Everything Financial Radio program. I'm your host, Dennis Tubergen. I have the pleasure of chatting today with Mr. Harry Dent. Harry is a best-selling business author. His recent book, The Demographic Cliff, How to Survive and Prosper During the Great Deflation of 2014 to 2019, is available. I'd encourage you to check it out. He's also the editor of the free newsletter, Economy and Markets. And Harry, we were chatting a bit about in the last segment about your forecast for stocks, which I don't know if the word dismal is the word you used, but I'll use it if that's fair. Let me ask you, if you go back and take a look at the tech stock bubble collapse that occurred in 2001, and the financial crisis occurred in 2007 to 2009, you talked about the fact that there's always a trigger that starts these events. What's it going to be this time?
Well, I think the markets are really underestimating this drop in energy, oil prices and the fracking bubble. People, we've been told now for years that the U.S. has a whole revolution in energy. It's leading. It's going to make us self-sufficient and exporters. This is a total bunk. This fracking bubble is a bubble industry. The Fed, by pushing long-term Treasury rates down under 2%, junk bonds that are used to finance this risky drilling used to be 8 to 10%. Now they're 5 to 5.5% up until recently. This cheap financing has made these companies profitable. The second thing, oil prices, if you remember, dropped from $147 to $32 in 4.5 months in 2008, the fastest bubble burst I have ever seen anywhere. And only because of the massive stimulus and quantitative easing did the economy bounce back and oil got back above $100 a barrel. But it didn't stay there. We've been warning people that was a long-term peak. Oil is ultimately going to $10 to $20 a barrel and certainly back to the 2008 lows of $32. And this makes all these frackers, they need $55 to $80 to make it, to break even. So there's going to be no more fracking drilling. A lot of these companies are going to default on their debt, and they've been a huge employment surge, especially for Texas and North Dakota, a million jobs created or more. So I think this is the trigger, and people say, well, that's not that big. Well, all it took to trigger the 2008 worldwide financial crisis and Great Recession was four states having a subprime mortgage crisis. All four states, California, Nevada, Arizona, Florida, were the crux of that. Four states triggered the whole world. And the only reason, as we show in the book, we have a whole chapter that shows debt around the world. We have unprecedented debts, unprecedented unfunded entitlements by governments for retirement and health care and things like that. And all it takes is something to go wrong for people to start worrying about all this debt. And then the more the debt defaults, the more other debts default, and you just get a chain reaction, and that's what happened in 2008. So I think that is the beginning. Commodity prices are collapsing. It's not just oil around the world. That hurts emerging countries, and a lot of emerging country companies borrow money from U.S. banks or in U.S. dollar-denominated loans and bonds, and those are going to keep defaulting. So we just get defaults, and the biggest default is going to be the China bubble. Mark my words, Dennis, on this. The China bubble is the greatest real estate bubble in history. It is starting to crack. When it does, it's going to absolutely annihilate wealth in China. Chinese save way more than we do, and they put 75% of it in real estate. We only put like 28%. So this is going to be a huge blow to China, and that's the last domino to fall. Singapore is already cracking. It's the most expensive city in the world. It's so expensive from foreign buyers that the government has had now slapped huge taxes on foreign buyers, and that demand's drying up, and the Singapore market's going to be crashing, already down 5%, but it's going to be crashing by next year. So plenty of things to trigger this, and yet, the Fed's saying, oh, this isn't a bubble, everything's okay, and stock investors think there's no chance we could have more than a 10 or 20% correction. They are going to be wrong about this.
So, Harry, you talk about the fracking bubble. That was a great explanation. To what extent is this bubble driven by demographics, or is it more driven by monetary policy?
No, that was total monetary policy. That bubble would have never happened without zero interest rates. What the Fed has basically done, Dennis, if you want to get simple about it, they've set short-term interest rates to zero, which they can do by decree. That's the lowest they've ever been. That's crazy. It's free money. But with quantitative easing, which is unprecedented, they've never done this outside of World War II to any extent, they've just printed money out of thin air to buy Treasury and other long-term bonds to push down long-term rates. Now you've got Treasury bonds, 10-year Treasury bonds, it plus or minus 2% with 2% average inflation in recent years. That is zero interest rate adjusted for inflation long-term. So we've got zero interest rates. When you get zero interest rates, investors will speculate. This fracking bubble all of a sudden becomes profitable. So you build up these bubbles in assets. Stocks just go up and up and up. And at some point, something's going to go wrong, and then these bubbles are going to burst. The problem with quantitative easing is not that it's going to cause inflation, because the money's not going into lending in the normal things it does. It's just going into speculation. David Stockman calls it the casino economy. So this is the most dangerous bubble we've had. It's not only at new highs for almost all the major markets, but it is totally artificially driven. I mean, at least the tech bubble of the 90s saw super high productivity, super high growth of a new sector. The baby boomers were in their strongest spending phase in the 90s when that happened. Now baby boomers are in a down phase. Debt has got, we've added in the world, $57 trillion more debt, more than we added from 2000 to 2007 in the last bubble. I mean, we've added more debt. The demographics are getting worse and worse. This whole thing is fueled by quantitative easing. And when something goes wrong, this thing is going to crash probably faster and harder than it did last time.
So, Harry, we get a crash. We see the beginnings of this asset pricing reset. The Fed is going to try to respond. What do you think they'll do, and how effective will it be the next time around?
I think it'll be too late. You know, but I think the economy is going to slow this year. Retail sales have already been surprisingly down. We warned last year that Germany was going to slow down, and they keep slowing more than expected. I think, you know, somewhere like maybe the third quarter, they're going to finally figure out the economy is getting a little too slow, and I think that's going to be too late. They're going to be behind the curve. I mean, they did taper off as of late last year. So I think they will try to respond, but I also think that if we see another crash and another meltdown or start to see it, I think the American public, I mean, I think everybody's always been thinking in the back of their heads, you know, you don't get something for nothing. And this free money thing is really something for nothing. But the economy's done okay, so people are like, well, maybe it's working. I think if this thing fails, I think the public's going to say, look, no more. You already printed $3.5 trillion, and we printed $11 trillion around the world and dumped it in the economy, and here we are crashing worse than last time. This doesn't work, and you don't get something for nothing. So I think there could be a public revolt. I think the Fed could start later this year, okay, we're going to go back to $1 trillion a year QE, and I think this time people will say, you're going to do the same thing again that just failed?
So, Harry, talk about the deflation you're predicting over the next 5 years, and to what extent will that be attributable to private sector debt, and to what extent will it be attributable to public sector debt?
Well, you know, it'll be almost all private sector debt. Government debt only goes up in a downturn because their tax revenues go down and their social expenses and all this sort of stuff goes up. But the good news is the private debt at the top of the bubble in 2008 was three times the government debt, and now it's two times because the government debt has gone up. But we have about $40 trillion in private debt. And in the Great Depression, more than half of our private debt just disappeared. It got restructured. It failed. So that's good. We're going to get a huge burden taken off, but that destroys money. And like you say, you know, there's trillions and trillions of dollars in financial assets and the stock market and housing, all this stuff, and that's going to devalue. All of this destroys money, and it happens very rapidly, especially that the financial assets break the fastest and then the private debt breaks. Long-term, government debt will go down as a percentage of GDP, but the government debt is the one thing that will not go down. But again, deflation throughout history has always followed bubbles. It's where you see the most extreme stock crashes, 89%. In the 1930s was the last great debt and financial asset bubble that burst the United States. And stocks weren't just down the normal 50 to 70% in a major long-term crisis like in the 1970s and the 73-74 crisis. They're down 80 to 90%. And I think the Dow ultimately when all of our indicators kind of bottom out, start to bottom out around the early 2020s, I think you could see 3,000 to 4,000. But I think the next stop, the next crash, is going to take us more like to 6,000. So again, not something to sit through as an investor. You've got to protect your assets. Look, we've had the greatest bubble and boom in modern history. Take your assets off the table. Wait and see if I'm right. And I tell you, I think within a year, you're going to know if I'm right. You don't have to stay out of the market forever. But if we don't see a crash start by early 2016 at the latest, and then, you know, maybe I'm missing something. But I'm telling you, I've done my homework. And this is a bubble, looks like a bubble, quacks like a bubble. Everybody's saying it's not a bubble. All you got to do is lay the stock market over the 94 to 2000 bubble, and you'll see this is almost identical. Bubbles always burst, no exceptions in history.
So, Harry, we've got about 2 minutes left. What are you advising your newsletter readers to do with their assets?
Well, you know, it's just like in a boom, you know, you have to look at your risk tolerance. For a lot of investors, I would just say be in safe short-term government bonds. Get little or no yield. You're protecting your money, and you think you're not earning money, but every time things go down, from real estate to stocks to gold to oil, anything else, your same amount of money now can buy much more of it. You are gaining purchasing power by holding money. Now, if somebody wants to take a little more risk, the U.S. dollar, not gold and silver, and I've been arguing this for years, and I've won so many bets on this, gold and silver crashed in late 2008 when the crisis hit. The U.S. dollar went up 27%. The U.S. dollar has been up mostly ever since, and it'll go up, I think, another 30-40% from here. The U.S. dollar versus other currencies, you can buy an ETF like UUP, or you can buy a dollar bull fund. That should be the safe haven, and you can actually make some money rather than just protecting your money. And then if you want to go another step, you can short things like the S&P 500 or the NASDAQ tech stocks. And you can have a small amount of your money short, or you can buy an option to protect your portfolio that'll pay off if we do see this crash. So that's the array of things you could do. But there aren't many options. Only high-quality bonds and the U.S. dollar are going to go up. Everything else is going to go down like 2008. So it's not like you can diversify and say, well, I got some in real estate and I got some in emerging markets and some in commodities and some in stocks. No, that won't work. So you really have to narrow down, but you can still diversify. You could be part short stocks, part long dollar, part short-term high-quality bonds, and have some diversification.
Well, our guest today has been Mr. Harry Dent, best-selling author. His most recent book, The Demographic Cliff, How to Survive and Prosper During the Great Deflation of 2014 to 2019. I'd encourage you to check it out. And you can check out his free newsletter at harrydent.com. Harry, thanks for joining us today.
Okay. Thank you, Dennis.
Everything Financial Radio returns after these words. Welcome back to the Everything Financial Radio program. I'm your host, Dennis Tubergen, and thanks again to our special guest expert this week, Mr. Harry Dent, for joining us. I've had a lot of requests to talk about Social Security collection options on the program. We've been conducting a series of Maximize My Social Security workshops. We also talk about how to maximize your Social Security at our new retirement rules class. And in this segment, I want to give you a bit of a preview, a bit of an overview as to some common Social Security collection mistakes. So if you're between the ages of 55 and 65, and you are either collecting Social Security or you've not yet started to collect Social Security, or you know someone that is, you'll probably want to reference this segment and perhaps even get the podcast, which is available at the iTunes Store by simply searching under Everything Financial Radio. Now, as I start this conversation about how to collect Social Security and potentially maximize it for your situation, I need to talk a little bit about some definitions that you're going to need to understand. And the first one is, what is a normal retirement age? Well, a normal retirement age, as far as Social Security is concerned, is the age at which you can collect full benefits. They're called primary insurance benefits, but you can collect your full primary insurance benefit at your normal retirement age. Now, if you were born between 1943 and 1954, your normal retirement age is 66. If you were born 1960 or later, your normal retirement age is 67. If you were born in the interim years from 1955 to 1959, your normal retirement age will increase from 66 and 2 months to 66 and 10 months by 2 months every year. So, for example, the normal retirement age for someone born in 1954 is 66. If you're born in 1955, it's 66 and 2 months. In 1956, it's 66 and 4 months, and so on until 1960 or later when the normal retirement age is 67. Now, if you draw your Social Security at age 62, which is the earliest point at which you can draw Social Security without being disabled, your normal retirement age benefit, your primary insurance benefit that you would collect at your normal retirement age, is reduced by 25%. So if your normal retirement age is 66 and you want to draw at 62, you're going to get a benefit that's reduced by 25%. If your normal retirement age is 67, and you draw at age 62 rather than waiting until 67, your benefit will be reduced by 30%. Now, interestingly, when you look the other way, when you go in the opposite direction, what if you say, I'm not going to collect my benefits early, but I'm going to collect my benefits later? I'm going to defer collecting my Social Security benefits until some point beyond my normal retirement age. Well, if that's the case, your benefits, the amount that you collect, will increase by 0.67% per month or 8% per year. Now, this is simple interest only. This increase is simple interest only. So if your normal retirement age is 66, your age 70 benefit will be 132% of your age 66 benefit. Now, it makes no sense to defer beyond age 70 because your delayed benefit credits expire at age 70. So that's the latest date at which it makes sense for you to defer collecting benefits. So let's walk through a couple examples. Let's take a lady that is 66 years old today. That's her normal retirement age. And she can collect Social Security benefits of about $25,400 a year, a little more than $25,000 a year. If she waits until 67, her benefit will increase from $25,400 to $27,400 roughly. At 68, $29,500. At 69, $31,500. And at 70, $33,500. And obviously, I've rounded those numbers. Now, whenever you do Social Security maximization planning, you have to assume something. I've worked in the financial industry for a long time, and the financial industry likes to work on assumptions. However, let me tell you from my experience that the one thing I've learned about assumptions is that they're almost always wrong. It's difficult to look into the future and know exactly what's going to happen. So for our discussion today, I'm going to assume that this lady will live to exactly age 85. If she lives to age 85, if she started drawing the benefits she could at age 66, which if you think back was about $25,400 a year, by the time she's 85, she would have collected about $508,000. However, if she were to wait to collect benefits until age 70, when she could collect about $33,500 a year instead of $25,400 a year, so it's about an $8,000 increase, she at age 85 would have collected about $537,000. So she collects almost $30,000 more in terms of real dollars. Now, the other thing you have to think about is, what will the inflation rate be? Because we know, as we've talked about here on the program, the U.S. dollar has lost purchasing power over time. So we have to assume something for an inflation rate, and as I've talked about, we don't believe that the inflation rate in the future will be significant, but certainly dollars will likely not buy more than they buy today. So we have to come up with some inflation rate. And if we were to assume an inflation rate of 3%, meaning that a dollar today is going to be worth 97 cents a year from now, and we just take that and extrapolate it forward, then if you take a look at inflation-adjusted benefits, this lady probably does not want to wait until age 70 to collect, because devaluing dollars by 3% each year would mean that she will likely not collect as much in terms of real purchasing power by waiting to age 70. She'd probably want to wait until age 69 or so in this analysis. So there's a lot of moving parts when you do Social Security benefit planning. But one of the big things that people often miss is the ability of one spouse, if you're married, to collect a free spousal benefit. Let's take the example of a married couple. And let's say that in this married couple, the husband is 61 years old, the wife is 65 years old. Well, that's a perfect age spread for collecting Social Security benefits. Because what can happen is if the lady in this example is collecting Social Security benefits, when the husband reaches age 66, which is his normal retirement age, he can start to collect a free spousal benefit. That spousal benefit is half the benefit his spouse in this example would receive at her normal retirement age. So if she were going to receive $25,000 a year at age 66, he would get $12,500 a year at age 66. Now, why would he want to do this? Well, everybody's situation is different, but one of the reasons that you would want to consider this is that if you draw a free spousal benefit at your normal retirement age, your primary benefit continues to grow at 8% per year from age 66 to age 70. So in other words, in this example, the husband could collect the free spousal benefit for 4 years from age 66 to 70, so he's still collecting a benefit. And then, because he's collecting a spousal benefit, his primary benefit, based on his earnings history, grows by 32% from age 66 to age 70. And that is a free spousal benefit that's even available if you're divorced. As long as you were married for at least 10 years, you might be able to draw a free spousal benefit on your ex-spouse's earnings history. This can make a significant difference, particularly when you think about the fact that if you're married, your survivor benefit from Social Security is the larger of the two benefits that you and your spouse are collecting. Now, we talk in detail about Social Security collection strategies at our new retirement rules class. In fact, we have a program that we've licensed from Professor Lawrence Kotlikoff. And if that name sounds familiar, it probably does, in fact, if you've been a longtime listener to the program. Professor Kotlikoff has been here on the program. Professor Kotlikoff served on the Council of Economic Advisors for President Reagan. He's now a professor at Boston University, and he has a company called Maximize My Social Security, in which he helps people determine what's the best Social Security collection strategy for their individual situation. We have that program, and we make it available to folks that attend the new retirement rules class. So if you'd like to attend the new retirement rules class and learn more about income planning in today's economic environment, learn more about economic cycles and money cycles, as well as Social Security maximization strategies, I'd invite you to go to the website, New Retirement Rules, and check it out. You can get more information there about the class. Our next class is coming up on March the 28th. That is a Saturday. You can also register at that website while capacity remains. So again, the website, newretirementrules.com. Quick reminder, if you'd like to listen to any of this information again, simply go to iTunes and download the podcast by searching under Everything Financial Radio. That's the show for this week. Hope you got something you can use. Have a great week.